her own uncertainty. Indeed, she cannot be aware of how deeply humiliated, despised, and devalued her child feels, if she herself has never consciously suffered these feelings, and if she tries to fend them off with irony. The same can be said for most psychiatrists, clinical psychologists, and therapists. Certainly they do not use words like bad, dirty, naughty, egoistic, rotten, but among themselves they sometimes speak of narcissistic, exhibitionistic, destructive, regressive, or borderline patients, without noticing that they give these words a pejorative meaning. It may be that their abstract vocabulary, their supposedly objective attitudes, even the way they formulate their theories and zealously make their diagnoses, all have something in common with a mother's contemptuous looks, which they could, if they were willing, trace to the accommodating 3-year-old girl or boy within themselves. It is understandable that a patient's scornful attitude could induce a therapist to protect his superiority with the help of theory. But if he builds such a wall, the patient's true self will not be visible to him. It will hide from him, just as it did from the mother's disgusted eyes. We could, however, make good use of our sensitivity by instead detecting pieces of the story of a despised child that lie behind all the patient's expressions of contempt. When the therapist's resources are used in this way, it is easier for him not to feel he is being attacked and to drop his need to hide behind his theories. Knowledge of theory is essential, but knowledge of the theory must not have a defensive function. It must not become the successor of a strict, controlling mother, forcing the therapist to accommodate himself to it. Depravity as evil in Hermann Hesse's childhood world. It is very difficult to describe how people deal with the contempt under which they suffered as children, especially the contempt for all their sensual enjoyment and pleasure in living, without giving concrete examples. With the aid of theoretical models, I could certainly describe the various defense mechanisms, especially the defense against feelings. But doing so would fail to communicate the emotional climate, which alone evokes a person's suffering, and so makes identification and empathy possible for the reader. With purely theoretical representations, we therapists remain outside. From there we can talk about the others, classify, group, and label them by making diagnoses, and discuss them in a language only we understand. If we refuse to do all that, we need examples. It is only through the details of a specific life that we can show how a person has experienced the naughtiness of his childhood as wickedness itself. Only the history of an individual life can make us realize how impossible it is for a child to recognize his parents' compulsions as such, and to realize that this blindness can persist throughout the adult's whole life, try as he may to break out of his inner prison. I use the example of the poet and novelist Hermann Hesse to demonstrate this very complicated situation. This example has the advantage of having been published, and published by the person himself, so that the connections that I postulate can be clarified with concrete examples from his life. At the beginning of his novel, Damien, Hermann Hesse describes the goodness and purity of a parental home in which there is no room for a child's fibs. It is not difficult to recognize the author's own parental home in this novel, and he confirms this indirectly. The child is alone with his sin and feels that he is depraved, wicked, and outcast, though nobody scolds him, since no one as yet knows the terrible facts. This situation is, of course, a common one in real life, and Hesse's idealized way of describing such a pure household is not strange to us either. It reflects both the child's point of view and the hidden cruelty of commonplace methods, with which we are only too familiar, used to teach moral values. Like most parents, writes Hesse, mine were no help with the new problems of puberty, to which no reference was ever made. All they did was take endless trouble in supporting my hopeless attempts to deny reality and to continue dwelling in a childhood world that was becoming more and more unreal. I have no idea whether parents can be of help, and I do not blame mine. It was my own affair to come to terms with myself and to find my own way, and like most well-brought-up children, I managed it badly. A child's parents seem to him to be free of sexual desires, for they have means and possibilities of hiding their sexual activities, whereas the child is always under surveillance. In his story, A Child's Heart, Hesse writes, the adults acted as if the world were perfect, and as if they themselves were demigods. We children were nothing but scum. Again and again, after a few days, even after a few hours, something happened that should not have been allowed, something wretched, depressing, and shaming. Again and again, in the midst of the noblest and staunchest decisions and vows, I fell abruptly, inescapably, into sin and wickedness, into ordinary bad habits. Why was it this way? The first part of Damien, it seems to me, is very evocative and easy to appreciate, even for people from quite different milieus. What makes the later parts of the novel so peculiarly difficult must in some way be related to Hesse's parents' and grandparents' moral values. They were missionary families. These permeate many of his stories, but can perhaps be most easily sensed in Damien. Although Sinclair, the hero, has already had his own experience of cruelty, blackmail by an older boy, it has given him no key to a better understanding of the world. Wickedness, for him, is depravity. Here is the missionary's language. It is neither hate nor cruelty, but such trivialities as drinking in a tavern. As a little boy, Hermann Hesse took over from his parents this particular concept of wickedness as depravity. It is like a foreign body that he seeks to locate and uproot from his personality. This is why everything that happens in Damien after the appearance of the god Abraxas, who is to unite the godly and the devilish, is so curiously removed. Wickedness is supposed to be artfully united with goodness here, but we are not touched by it. One has the impression that for the boy, this is something strange, threatening, and above all unknown, from which he nevertheless cannot free himself. His emotional belief in depravity is already joined to fear and guilt. Once more, I was trying most strenuously to construct an intimate world of light for myself out of the shambles of a period of devastation. Once more, I sacrificed everything within me to the aim of banishing darkness and evil from myself. In the Zurich exhibition, 1977, to commemorate the centennial of Hesse's birth, a picture was displayed that had hung above the little Hermann's bed and that he had grown up with. In this picture, on the right, we see the good road to heaven, full of thorns, difficulties, and suffering. On the left, we see the easy, pleasurable road that inevitably leads to hell. Taverns play a prominent part on this road, probably because devout women hope to keep their husbands and sons away from these wicked places with this threatening representation. These taverns play an important role in Damien. Ironically so, because Hesse had no urge at all to get drunk in such taverns, though he certainly did wish to break out of the narrowness of his parents' values. Every child forms his first image of what is bad, quite concretely, by what is forbidden, by his parents' prohibitions, taboos, and fears. He will have a long way to go before he can free himself from these parental values and see without filters what he has believed to be badness in himself, He will then no longer regard it as depraved and wicked, but as a comprehensible, latent reaction to injuries he had to repress when a child. As an adult, he can discover the causes and free himself from this unconscious reaction. He also has the opportunity to apologize for what he has done to others out of ignorance, blindness, and confusion. And doing so will help him to avoid repetitions of acts he no longer wishes to continue. Unfortunately, the path to clarification was not open to Hermann Hesse. The following passage from Damien shows how deeply the perceived loss of his parents' love threatened his search for his true self. But where we have given of our love and respect, not from habit, but of our own free will, where we have been disciples and friends out of our inmost hearts, it is a bitter and horrible moment when we suddenly recognize that the current within us wants to pull us away from what is dearest to us. Then every thought that rejects the friend and mentor turns on our own hearts like a poisoned barb. Then each blow struck in defense flies back into one's own face. The words disloyalty and ingratitude strike the person who feels he was morally sound like catcalls and stigma, and the frightened heart flees timidly back to the charmed valleys of childhood virtues, unable to believe that this break too must be made, this bond also broken. And in his story, A Child's Heart, we read, "If I were to reduce all my feelings and their painful conflicts to a single name, I can think of no other word but dread. It was dread, dread and uncertainty, that I felt in all those hours of shattered childhood felicity. Dread of punishment, dread of my own conscience, dread of stirrings in my soul which I considered forbidden and criminal." In this story, Hesse portrays with great tenderness and understanding the feelings of an 11-year-old boy who has stolen some dried figs from his beloved father's room so that he could have in his possession something that belongs to his father. Guilt feelings, fear, and despair torment him in his loneliness and are replaced at last by the deepest humiliation and shame when his wicked deed is discovered. The strength of this portrayal leads us to surmise that it concerns a real episode from Hesse's own childhood. This surmise becomes certainty thanks to a note made by his mother on November 11, 1889. "Hermann's theft of figs discovered." From the entries in his mother's diary, and from the extensive exchange of letters between both parents and various members of the family, which have been available since 1966, it is possible to guess at the small boy's painful path. Hesse, like so many gifted children, was so difficult for his parents to bear, not despite, but because of his inner riches. Often a child's very gifts, his great intensity of feeling, depth of experience, curiosity, intelligence, quickness, and his ability to be critical, will confront his parents with conflicts that they have long sought to keep at bay by means of rules and regulations. These regulations must then be rescued at the cost of the child's development. All this can lead to an apparently paradoxical situation when parents who are proud of their gifted child, and who even admire him, are forced by their own repression to reject, suppress, or even destroy what is best because truest in that child. Two of Hesse's mother's observations may illustrate how this work of destruction can be combined with apparent loving care. 1. 1881. "Hermann is going to nursery school. His violent temperament causes us much distress." The child was 3 years old. 2. 1884. "Things are going better with Hermann, whose education causes us so much distress and trouble. From the 21st of January to the 5th of June, he lived wholly in the boys' house and only spent Sundays with us. He behaved well there, but came home pale, thin, and depressed. The effects are decidedly good and salutary. He is much easier to manage now. The child was 7 years old. On November 14, 1883, his father, Johannes Hesse, wrote, "Hermann, who was considered almost a model of good behavior in the boy's house, is sometimes hardly to be borne, though it would be very humiliating for us. I am earnestly considering whether we should not place him in an institution or another household. We are too nervous and weak for him, and the whole household is too undisciplined and irregular. He seems to be gifted for everything. He observes the moon and the clouds, extemporizes for long periods on the harmonium, draws wonderful pictures with pencil or pen, can sing quite well when he wants to, and is never at a loss for a rhyme." In the strongly idealized picture of his childhood and his parents that we encounter in Hermann Lauscher, Hesse has completely abandoned the original rebellious, difficult, and for his parents, troublesome child he once was. He had no way to accommodate this important part of his self, and so was forced to expel it. Perhaps this is why his great and genuine longing for his true self remained unfulfilled. Excerpt from Hermann Lauscher. "When my childhood at times stirs my heart, it is like a gold-framed, deep-toned picture in which predominates a wealth of chestnuts and alders, an indescribably delightful morning light, and a background of splendid mountains. All the hours in my life in which I was allowed a short period of peace, forgetful of the world, all the lonely walks which I took over beautiful mountains, all the moments in which an unexpected happiness or love without desire carried me away from yesterday and tomorrow, all these can be given no more precious name than when I compared them with this green picture of my earliest life." That Hermann Hesse was not deficient in courage, talent, or depth of feeling is, of course, evident in his works and in many of his letters, especially the outraged letter from the institution in Stettin. But his father's answer to this letter, his mother's notes, and the passages from Demian and A Child's Heart, just quoted, show us clearly how the crushing weight of the denial of his childhood pain pressed on him, despite his enormous acclaim and success, and despite the Nobel Prize. Hesse, in his mature years, suffered from the tragic and painful state of being separated from his true self, to which doctors refer offhandedly as depression. The mother as society's agent during the first years of life. If we were to tell a patient that in other societies his perversion would not be a problem, that it is a problem here only because it is our society that is sick and produces constrictions and constraints, we would certainly be telling him at least a partial truth, but it would be of little help to him. He would feel, rather, that as an individual, with his own individual history, he was being passed over and misunderstood. For this interpretation makes too little of his own very real tragedy. What he most needs to understand is his compulsion to repeat, and the state of affairs behind it, to which this compulsion bears witness. His plight is no doubt the result of social pressures, but these do not have their effect on his psyche through abstract knowledge. They are firmly anchored in his earliest affective experience with his mother. Thus his problems cannot be solved with words, but only through experience, not merely corrective experience as an adult, but above all through a conscious experience of his early fear of his beloved mother's contempt and his subsequent feelings of indignation and sadness. Mere words, however skilled the interpretation, will leave unchanged or even deepen the split between intellectual speculation and the knowledge of the body, the split from which he already suffers. One can therefore hardly free an addict from the cruelty of his addiction by showing him how the absurdity, exploitation, and perversity of society cause our neuroses and perversions, however true this may be. The addict will love such explanations and eagerly believe them because they spare him the pain of the truth. But things we can see through do not make us sick, although they may arouse our indignation, anger, sadness, or feelings of impotence. What makes us sick are those things we cannot see through, society's constraints that we have absorbed through our parents' eyes. No amount of reading or learning can free us from those eyes. To put it another way, many people suffering from severe symptoms are very intelligent. They read in newspapers and books about the absurdity of the arms race, about exploitation through capitalism, diplomatic insincerity, the arrogance and manipulation of power, submission of the weak, and the impotence of individuals. And they have given thought to these subjects. What they do not see, because they cannot see them, are the absurdities enacted by their own mothers when they were still tiny children. Oppression and the forcing of submission do not begin in the office, factory, or political party. They begin in the very first weeks of an infant's life. Afterward, they are repressed and are then, because of their very nature, inaccessible to argument. Nothing changes in the character of submission or dependency when it is only their object that is changed. Political action can be fed by the unconscious rage of children who have been misused, imprisoned, exploited, cramped, and drilled. This rage can be partially discharged in fighting enemies, without having to give up the idealization of one's own parents. The old dependency will then simply be shifted to a new group or leader. If, however, disillusionment and the resultant mourning can be lived through, social and political disengagement do not usually follow, but our actions are freed from the compulsion to repeat. They can then have a clear goal, formed out of conscious decisions. Once our own reality has been faced and experienced, the inner necessity to keep building up new illusions and denials in order to avoid the experience of that reality disappears. We then realize that all our lives we have feared and struggled to ward off something that really cannot happen any longer. It has already happened at the very beginning of our lives while we were completely dependent. Therapeutic effects, in the form of temporary improvement, may be achieved if a strict conscience can be replaced by the therapist's or the group's more tolerant one. The aim of therapy, however, is not to correct the past, but to enable the patient both to confront his own history and to grieve over it. The patient has to discover early memories within himself and must become consciously aware of his parents' unconscious manipulation and contempt so that he can free himself from them. As long as he has to make do with a substitute tolerance, borrowed from his therapist or his group, the contemptuous attitudes he inherited from his parents will remain hidden in his unconscious, unchanged, despite all his improved intellectual knowledge and intentions. This contemptuous attitude will show itself in the patient's human relationships and will continue to torment him as long as it functions in the cells of his body. The contents of the unconscious remain unchanged and timeless. It is only as these contents become conscious that change can begin. The loneliness of the contemptuous. The contempt shown by many disturbed people may have various forerunners in their life history, but the function all expressions of contempt have in common is the defense against unwanted feelings. Contempt simply evaporates, having lost its point, when it is no longer useful as a shield, against the child's shame over his desperate, unreturned love, against his feeling of inadequacy, or above all, against his rage that his parents were not available. Once we are able to feel and understand the repressed emotions of childhood, we will no longer need contempt as a defense against them. On the other hand, as long as we despise the other person and overvalue our own achievements, he can't do what I can do, we do not have to mourn the fact that love is not forthcoming without achievement. Nevertheless, if we avoid this mourning, it means that we remain at bottom the one who is despised, for we have to despise everything in ourselves that is not wonderful, good, and clever. Thus we perpetuate the loneliness of childhood. We despise weakness, helplessness, uncertainty, in short, the child in ourselves and in others. The contempt for others in grandiose, successful people always includes disrespect for their own true selves, as their scorn implies. Without these superior qualities of mine, a person is completely worthless. This means, further, without these achievements, these gifts, I could never be loved, would never have been loved. Grandiosity in the adult guarantees that the illusion continues. I was loved. The way out of this confusing and stressful self-betrayal may well be illustrated by John's dream. John, 48, who came back to therapy because of tormenting obsessions, repeatedly dreamed that he was on a lookout tower that stood in a swampy area at the edge of a town dear to him. In reality, the town had no such tower, but it belonged unequivocally to John's dream landscape, and he knew it well. From there he had a lovely view, but he felt sad and deserted. There was an elevator in the tower, and in the dream there were all kinds of difficulties over entrance tickets and obstacles on the way to this tower. The dream recurred often, with the same feelings of being deserted. Only after much had changed in the course of therapy were there new variations in the dream, too, and at last it changed in a decisive way. John was first surprised to dream that he already had entrance tickets, but the tower had been demolished, and there was no longer a view. Instead, he saw a bridge that joined the swampy district to the town. He could thus go on foot into the town and see, not everything, but some things close up. John, who suffered from an elevator phobia, was somewhat relieved, for he had felt considerable anxiety riding in this elevator. Speaking of the dream, he said he was perhaps no longer dependent on always having a complete view, on always seeing everything, being on top and cleverer than other people. He now could go on foot, like everyone else. John was the more astonished when he later dreamed that he was suddenly sitting in this elevator in the tower again, and was being drawn upward as in a chairlift, without feeling any fear. He enjoyed the ride, got out at the top, and, strange to say, found colorful life all about him. He was on a plateau from which he had a view of the valleys. There was also a town up there, with a bazaar full of colorful wares, a school where children were practicing ballet, and he could join in. This had been a childhood wish, and groups of people holding discussions with whom he sat and talked. He felt integrated into this society, just as he was. Although the dream expressed his wishes rather than reality, it showed him his true, real needs, to be loved and to love beyond his achievements. This dream impressed him deeply. He said, "My earlier dreams of the tower showed my isolation and loneliness. At home, as the eldest, I was always ahead of my siblings. My parents could not match my intelligence, and in all intellectual matters I was alone. On the one hand, I had to demonstrate my knowledge in order to be taken seriously, and on the other, I had to hide it, or my parents would say, Your studies are going to your head. Do you think you are better than everyone else just because you have the chance to study? Without your mother's sacrifice and your father's hard work, you would never have been able to do it. That made me feel guilty, and I tried to hide my difference, my interests, and my gifts. I wanted to be like the others. There was no way for me to be true to myself, to respect me as I really was. So John had searched for his tower and had struggled with obstacles on the way with entrance tickets, his fears, and more. And when he got to the top, that is, was smarter than the others, he felt lonely and deserted. It is a well-known and common paradox that parents who take up this grudging and competitive attitude toward their child at the same time urge him on to the greatest achievement and are proud of his success. Thus, John had to look for his tower and had to encounter obstacles as well. Eventually, he went through a revolt against this pressure toward achievement and stress, and so the tower disappeared in the first of the dreams I have described here. He could give up his grandiose fantasy of seeing everything from above and could look at things in his beloved town, in himself, from close by. Only now did it become clear to him that he had felt compelled to isolate himself from others by means of his contempt, and at the same time was isolated and separated from his true self, at least from its helpless, uncertain part. Contempt, as a rule, will cease with the beginning of mourning for the irreversible that cannot be changed. For contempt, too, has in its own way served to deny the reality of the past. It is, after all, less painful to think that the others do not understand because they are too stupid. Then one can make efforts to explain things to them, and the illusion of being understood, if only I can express myself properly, can be maintained. Devastating examples of this process are the works of Van Gogh, who so wonderfully and so unsuccessfully courted the favor of his mother with all the means at his disposal. If, however, this effort is relaxed, one is forced to realize that understanding was not possible, since the repression of the parents' own childhood needs made them blind to their children's needs. Even alert parents cannot always understand their children, but they will respect their children's feelings even when they cannot understand them. Where there is no such respect, their children seek refuge from a painful truth in ideologies. Nationalism, racism, and fascism are in fact nothing other than ideological guises of the flight from painful, unconscious memories of endured contempt into the dangerous, destructive disrespect for human life, glorified as a political program. The formerly hidden cruelty that was exercised upon the powerless child now becomes only too apparent in the violence of such political groups. Its origins in childhood, in the total disregard of the former child, however, remain concealed or absolutely denied, not only by the members of these groups, but by society as a whole. Achieving freedom from contempt and respecting life. Sexual perversions, obsessions, and flights into ideologies are not the only possibilities for perpetuating the tragedy of early suffering from contempt. There are countless ways we may transmit the family climate under which we suffered as children. There are people, for example, who never say a loud or angry word, who seem to be only good and noble, and who still give others the palpable feeling of being ridiculous, or stupid, or too noisy, or at any rate too common compared with themselves. They do not know it, and perhaps do not intend it, but this is what they radiate, the attitude of their parents, of which they have never been aware. The children of such persons find it particularly difficult to formulate any reproach until they learn to do so in their therapy. Then there are the people who can seem very friendly, if a shade patronizing, but in whose presence one feels as if one were nothing. They convey the feeling that they are the only ones who exist, the only ones who have anything interesting or relevant to say. The others can only stand there and admire them in fascination, or turn away in disappointment and sorrow about their own lack of worth, unable to express themselves in these persons' presence. These people might be the children of grandiose parents, whom they, as children, had no hope of emulating. But later, as adults, they unconsciously pass on this atmosphere to those around them. Quite a different impression will be given by those people who, as children, were intellectually far beyond their parents, and therefore admired by them, but who also, therefore, had to solve their own problems alone. These people, who give us a feeling of their intellectual strength and willpower, also seem to demand that we, too, ought to fight off any feeling of weakness with intellectual means. In their presence, one feels one can't be recognized as a person with problems, just as they and their problems were unrecognized by their parents, for whom they always had to be strong. Keeping these examples in mind, it is easy to see why some professors or writers who are quite capable of expressing themselves clearly will use language that is so convoluted and arcane that their students or readers must struggle angrily to acquire ideas that they then can make little use of. The students may well experience feelings similar to those their teacher was once forced to suppress in relation to his parents. If the students themselves become teachers one day, they will then have the opportunity to hand on this unusable knowledge like a priceless jewel, because it has cost them so much. It greatly aids the success of therapeutic work when we become aware of our parents' destructive patterns at work within us. But to free ourselves from these patterns, we need more than an intellectual awareness. We need an emotional confrontation with our parents in an inner dialogue. When the patient has emotionally worked through the history of her childhood and has thus regained her sense of being alive, the goal of therapy has been reached. She will then be able to use the tools she has learned whenever feelings from her past are triggered by present events. As time goes on, she will use them more and more effectively and will need less time for this work. The map of her life will be available for her whenever she needs it. The therapist must leave it up to the patient to decide whether she will take a regular job or not, whether she wants to live alone or with a partner, whether she wants to join a political party, and if so, which one. All of these decisions must be her own. Her life story, her experiences, and what she has learned from them will all play a role in how she will live. It is not the task of the therapist to socialize her, or to raise her consciousness, not even politically, for every form of indoctrination denies her autonomy, or to make friendships possible for her. All that is her own affair. When the patient has consciously and repeatedly experienced how the whole process of her upbringing manipulated and damaged her in her childhood, and with what desires for revenge this has left her, then she will see through manipulation more quickly than before, and will herself have less need to manipulate others. Such a patient will be able to join groups, if she wishes, without again becoming helplessly dependent or bound, for she has consciously gone through the helplessness and dependency of her childhood. She will be in less danger of idealizing people or systems, or being deceived by a guru in a sect, if she has realized clearly how, as a child, she took every word uttered by her mother or father for the deepest wisdom. She may momentarily experience, while listening to a lecture or reading a book, the same old childish fascination and admiration, but she will sooner recognize and reject the underlying emptiness that lurks behind these manipulative and seductive words. A person who has matured through her own experience cannot be tricked with fascinating, incomprehensible words. Finally, A person who has consciously worked through the whole tragedy of her own fate will recognize another's suffering more clearly, though the other may be trying to hide it. She will not be scornful of others' feelings, whatever their nature, because she takes her own feelings seriously and knows how to work with them. She surely will not keep the vicious circle of contempt turning. This achievement will have not only personal consequences for the individual and her family, but also far-reaching significance for society as a whole. People who discover their past with the help of their feelings, who learn through therapy to clarify these feelings, to look for their real causes, and to resolve the transference, will no longer be compelled to displace their hatred onto innocence in order to protect those who have in fact earned this hatred. They will be capable of hating what is hateful and of loving what deserves love. Once they dare to see who brought them to their plight and how it was done, they will be better oriented in present reality and able to avoid acting blindly, unconsciously. They will no longer behave like the mistreated children they were, children who must protect their parents and who therefore need a scapegoat for the buried emotions that torment them. The future of democracy and democratic freedom depends on our capacity to take this very step and to recognize that it is simply impossible to struggle successfully against hatred outside ourselves while ignoring its messages within. We must know and use the tools that are necessary to resolve it. We must feel and understand its source and its legitimacy. There is no point in appealing to our goodwill, our kindness, and a common spirit of love as long as the path to clarifying our feelings is blocked by the unconscious fear of our parents. Consciously experiencing our legitimate emotions is liberating, not just because of the discharge of long-held tensions in the body, but above all because it opens our eyes to reality, both past and present, and frees us of lies and illusions. It gives us back repressed memories and helps dispel attendant symptoms. It is therefore empowering without being destructive. Repressed emotion can be resolved as soon as it is felt, understood, and recognized as legitimate. Being detached from it becomes possible, and this is totally different from repression. But illegitimate hatred never disappears. It may switch scapegoats, but it will remain ever-present and undiluted. It cannot be appeased. It poisons and blinds the soul, devours the memory and the mind, and kills the capacity for compassion and insight. Its destructive power stems from a history of horror that has been repressed and stored in the body, but that without effective therapy has no direct access to the conscious mind. Hating and offending an innocent person, using him as a scapegoat, can only strengthen the walls of our inner prison of confusion, isolation, fear, and loneliness. It cannot free us. A house built out of self-betrayal will sooner or later fall down and mercilessly destroy human life, if not that of the builder, then that of his children, who will sense the lie without being aware of it, and who will end up paying the full price for this hidden arrangement. A person who can honestly and without self-deception deal with his feelings has no need to disguise them with the help of ideologies. The basic similarity of the various nationalistic movements flourishing today reveals that their motives have nothing to do with the real interests of the people who are fighting and hating, but instead have very much to do with those people's childhood histories, the mistreatment, humiliation, and exploitation of children is the same worldwide, as is the means of avoiding the memory of it. Individuals who do not want to know their own truth collude in denial with society as a whole, looking for a common enemy on whom to act out their repressed rage. But as the inhabitants of this shrinking planet near the end of the 20th century, the danger inherent in self-deception is growing exponentially. And we can afford it less than ever. Fortunately, at the same time, we now have the tools we need to truly understand ourselves as we were and as we are. Afterword for the 2007 edition. This book was first published almost 30 years ago. Even now, readers tell me that it brought into their lives the tormented, isolated, never understood child within them, whom they had forgotten and abandoned decades before. Many say that for the first time in their lives, they can feel the plight of this child and can cry about the pain of their childhood, of which they were not truly aware for such a long time. They often say, "You described my life and my family." And they ask, "How did you know them?" The strong emotional impact of this book may come from the fact that writing it brought about my own emotional awakening. It came with my decision to find my own history, to live my own life, and to leave behind me everything I felt was not actually me, was only the product of my upbringing. A decision like this initiates a process that needs time. I am happy now that I have used this time, almost 30 years, to become more and more free from conventional ways of thinking and from theories that were built to conceal and obscure the reality of childhood, the extraordinary pain we were exposed to, and the necessity to repress our feelings into our bodies, our unconsciousness, in order to survive. With this insight began the story of my research that included the childhood stories of dictators and famous writers who died very early. In all these cases, I found without any exceptions the same patterns. The denial of the once endured terror, the idolizing of the extremely abusive parents, and a destructive or self-destructive behavior as a result. My exploration of this reality found its expression in all my books, especially in the latest ones, The Body Never Lies and Your Saved Life, not yet translated into English. Also, articles and interviews on my website can provide the recent readers of The Drama of the Gifted Child with many conclusions to which my research on childhood brought me in the last 10 years. But above all, my answers to readers' mail can illustrate the concept of therapy that I developed in the last several years. In addition, many letters on the website show how people succeeded in overcoming their physical symptoms by facing the stories of their childhood, feeling their indignation, liberating themselves from their destructive self-blame, and becoming less and less dependent on their abusive parents. This encourages others to feel what they have tried to avoid their whole lives, and it demonstrates that these efforts are effective, that they often help to overcome even chronic illnesses, and that they are not at all dangerous. The once-beaten children still living inside adults often fear being punished if they dare to truly see, without illusions, what their parents did to them in their first years of life. Once they understand that this danger no longer exists, they can liberate their life. I assume that the website gives answers to the questions this audiobook raises, but without listening to it, without making this step, without opening the door to the child you once were, the full impact of the website may be missed. The child you have found by listening to The Drama of the Gifted Child will hopefully lead you to read the material on the website, to find the information you may need today, and to benefit from it. This has been a Hachette audio production of The Drama of the Gifted Child, The Search for the True Self, completely revised and updated with a new afterword by the author, written by Alice Miller, translated by Ruth Ward, read by Suzanne Torin, produced and post-production by Michelle McGonigal, directed by Charles McCrory, recorded at Hachette Audio Studios. The Drama of the Gifted Child is also available in print and as an e-book from Basic Books, a division of Hachette Book Group. For more Hachette Audio productions, visit us at hachetteaudio.com. Thank you for listening. Revised edition text, copyright 1997 by Basic Books. Afterword to the revised edition, copyright 2007 by Alice Miller. Originally published in German as Das Drama des begabten Kindes. Copyright 1979 by Surkamp Verlag, Frankfurt am Main. First published in the United States as Prisoners of Childhood. Copyright 1981 by Basic Books. Audio production, copyright 2018, Hachette Audio, all rights reserved. Hachette Book Group supports the right to free expression and the value of copyright. The purpose of copyright is to encourage writers and artists to produce the creative works that enrich our culture. The duplicating, uploading, and distribution of this audiobook without permission is a theft of the author's intellectual property. If you would like permission to use material from the audiobook, other than for review purposes, please contact permissions@hvgusa.com. Thank you for your support of the author's rights.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.